And now it's time for Queer Talk. Hey, Matthew.
Hey, how's it going, Ron?
Doing great. How are you doing?
Doing all right. It's very chilly today. Oh, my goodness. It was time for the thick socks and the gloves today, but it's beautiful. And anyway, I'm Matthew Stafford, and welcome back to another Queer Talk. Today we have John Baker from Alive Hospice on. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. So, John, tell us a little bit about... well, first of all, there's a gay men's grief support group that's coming up.
Yes.
With Alive Hospice. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'll be facilitating that group, and it is gay men's support group for loss of partner. We do have this group. I'll first give you the time frame. This group is going to be a 6-week group, and we will meet every Thursday starting February the 23rd. And we meet from 5:30 to 7 every Thursday for 6 weeks. This group is going to focus on the multiplicity of issues that face gay men who have lost their partner. We have a very general kind of guideline that try and focus in on individuals who've lost their partner, say, within the last 2 years. But that's always negotiable. So for anyone who's interested, they are welcome to call. Would like to have it to, you know, just to kind of get their name out there that will know they're interested in showing up. They would call 963-4732. Now, that is our grief hotline, and probably our support person there at intake, Holly, will give them a call back, or she may answer the phone herself, of course. And then I'll probably also give them a call after I get the information, because sometimes I'm in with clients, and often I can't answer the phone, so that's why that's set up like that.
And John, your role is as a grief counselor, essentially, with Alive,
right? Yes, yes. I am a grief counselor with Grief Support Services at Alive Hospice, mm-hmm. and I've been there 22 years into my 23rd, so I've been there a really long time.
What are the basic tenets of what Alive Hospice does in the community?
Well, Alive Hospice, we've been around for around 35 years. what we do, of course, is we are a nonprofit hospice, and we provide care for end-of-life care for individuals who have a life-threatening illness of any kind. And we provide that care in individuals' homes as well as our inpatient facilities that we have in Nashville.
And what this is a group setting that's coming up.
It is. Yeah.
There's also an opportunity for people to engage one-on-one with counseling.
Absolutely.
As well.
I'll mention that the support group, I don't want to have probably any more than maybe 10 to 12. Usually we cut our groups off around 12 individuals. So just to give people an idea that try and keep it small, try and keep it intimate. We can get a lot more done that way. And also to mention that individuals, of course, do not have to be associated with Alive Hospice, that we don't have to have provided services to them for them to be a part of the group. That's not one of the issues. So regardless, I mean, we provide services as far as our groups and as far as individual counseling to the community at large, not mm-hmm. just those who have received hospice services. Mm-hmm. So we do support groups all year long, and we cycle them. And as far as the individual counseling goes, we have several different grief counselors, and we have individual appointments all day long, 5 days a week, Monday through Friday. And we have a variety of times that we're there. So anyone who's interested in exploring the whole realm of grief counseling, regardless of what kind of loss you've had or how you lost your loved one, they can feel free to call us at the same number, 963-4732. Just leave a message, no matter who you've lost. If you feel like you're struggling and you just would like to come in and talk to someone, please call.
Mm-hmm. And I guess to step back a little bit, when it comes to the gay lesbian community component of this, some people might be thinking, well, what's the need for, you know, specifically tailored gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender component of grief counseling? And so I'm wondering if you could address that for a minute.
Yeah, I could probably talk about that a very long time, mm-hmm. so please interrupt me.
Well, I know you mentioned earlier when we were speaking about this, about the concept of disenfranchised grieving.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you could tell our audience a little bit about that.
Yeah, it became, I became aware of that issue early in my time working in a life hospice as a social worker. I spent a lot of time doing home care before I was doing grief counseling work. And, I became aware, particularly during a time whenever, you know, the AIDS epidemic was such a powerful, powerful thing in the community everywhere, and right here in good old Nashville as well. I became aware that there was a tremendous need for grief follow-up. And at that time, our grief services was very, very tiny, very small, as opposed to the way it is now. And I really was struck by the need of the unique needs that the gay community was obviously having to attempt to cope with from these enormous number of losses. And it was clear to me also that it was often expressed by family members, by the community at large, that whenever gay individuals, I'm kind of expressing my sentiments here, of course, for the gay community at large here, but their unique issues, the issues of being closeted, the issue of not being recognized by society, by the community at all. Even before an illness, even before death.
And have you seen changes in that over time? You've been with a live hospice for 22 years, so
yeah.
I'm wondering, have you seen some changes in that, especially the closeted portion, for example?
Yeah, I have. I have seen changes, and it's very good. I mean, I think, once again, obviously, there's a ways to go in many areas. And I think that involves death as well, illness as well, and grief as well. But I have seen some positive changes since those days. I think there can still be a response on family, friends, community to dismiss disenfranchised, as you said, to dismiss the grief that these individuals have after losing their partners, especially, and those who've been together for a brief period of time or for a long period of time. The response has historically been, well, that's not the same as me. I'm straight, you're gay, and you don't feel what I'd feel. And you know, that's what struck me. I think that's changing a bit, but I think there is still high potential, depending on the relationship dynamics that the couple have had with the family members, each family, that their grief can sometimes continue to be disenfranchised and not recognized because the relationship wasn't recognized, mm-hmm. never accepted.
Right.
So you can pretty much imagine that, you know, the grief isn't going to be accepted or recognized as legitimate.
Right.
So, you know, that was, my whole premise for beginning to offer something unique in which the gay community would be able to have a place to come and talk about what they're going through without, you know, feeling, well, nobody can relate to me because all you have or all I can find are straight loss of spouse groups, maybe. Mm-hmm. They're not that plentiful either. So, you know, I don't feel that it's the same thing. And, mm-hmm. and when I used to do the loss of spouse group, we would sometimes have someone from the gay community would call and say, I've lost my partner. I would like to be in a support group. Do you have anything? We say, oh, boy, you know, right now the only thing we got is loss of spouse. And we would invite, you know, come on, we'll figure it out. Come on down. But usually there was a sense of, you know, I don't think anyone in there is going to be able to relate to me, right, and et cetera. So that was even more motivation for me to say, look, let's offer something strictly, exclusively for the gay community, because their issues are unique. They really are. And actually, if they called and said, well, you know, I'd like to be part of the spouse group, I mean, we'd probably consider it. But we certainly would say, beware, you know, et cetera. But that's why I offered the support groups, and still do. Yeah.
It seems to be one of those issues where I'm sure you see it as a counselor, that it's just people, no matter who you are, have a need for empathy. Human beings have a need for empathy, to know that people understand them and to feel understood.
Yeah, well
put. Express themselves.
That's exactly right. The issue is exactly the same. It doesn't make any difference your lifestyle, what your preference is here, you know, sexually or otherwise. Grief is grief. And you know, there are no barriers to grief. Regardless, you know, when people have someone die that they truly, truly cherished and loved, you're going to have grief. And to have some place to go and to talk about that with someone who is truly going to listen and display some compassion and work very hard, as they would with anyone else, to help them understand what they're going through and to try and help them normalize their experience so that they understand that they're really not going crazy. They're just grieving. And to give them a place to process family dynamics and how crazy that can get, to give them a place to come and to develop new coping strategies and so on, just so they understand that what they're going through is not crazy, and that, you know, this isn't going to be over in, you know, a few days, a few weeks, or maybe even a few months, I think is very helpful.
And it's interesting on another level. I think that people, when they generally think of hospice, they think of end-of-life medical care, you know, the physical medical care.
Right.
And, you know, hospice is so much more than that. And it's more than just the individual. It's about their life, their family, their, you know, both family of origin and family, chosen family.
Exactly.
And their friends. And so there's that kind of support element, that social support element to it.
Absolutely. And we certainly try and address that on the front end as well as after the fact. We try and address that in terms of offering a treatment team, of course, that will not only address the medical, but a key component, of course, of end-of-life care is about the emotional, if not the spiritual as well. Physical is absolutely primary in regards to issues of pain control, etc. But there can be also a tremendous amount of emotional disturbance that goes along with the dying process, with the person who is ill, as well as with the loved ones around them. And one of the other components about this, of course, is that many gay couples are having families. And so the whole issue of the dying process becomes even further complicated in the issue of support if there are children involved. So that I think, you know, hospice truly has a place there with nurse, social worker, chaplain, home health aide, volunteers who can pitch in and try and prepare these individuals as best they can for the journey they're going to take. And then as well for them to know that when this is all done, you also have an extended support network waiting for you in terms of our grief services, so that you just aren't left behind here. There will be people waiting to help you carry on, because this continues on, of course. It isn't just up to the time of the death and then, okay, everybody packs up and goes home and good luck with the rest of your life here. This can just be the beginning of another journey. That one is complete. And now, if I'm aware enough, I have another journey to make here. And I think that is very important to pay attention to. If this person was indeed beloved and cherished. Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. We've been talking with John Baker from Alive Hospice, and we're going to take a brief break, and we will be right back.
throw some vodka caffeine. It's a carnival for all of y'all, so get in line. It's a carnival for all of y'all, get ready to ride.
That is Jason Dotley with Pop It. Back to you, Matthew.
All right. Welcome back to Queer Talk. I'm Matthew Stafford, and we're in the studio today with John Baker from Alive Hospice. John, again, thanks for being on the program.
Thank you very much, John.
So let's go back to talking about, we've been talking about the Gay Men's Grief Support group that's coming up. And just to briefly recap on that, that's going to begin on February 23rd,
yes.
Right? And registration is going on right now.
It is.
And what should people do if they wish to register for that?
Give us a call. Of course, we do have a website, livehospice.org, and, they could access us through there. But we would prefer, as far as actual registration for the support group, that you give us a call at 963-8732, and that will be our grief line,
mm-hmm.
and we'll take it from there. If you if no one answers the phone, please leave a message, and we'll get back with you quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can forward those calls to me eventually.
And just out of curiosity, what geographic area does Alive Hospice serve?
Well, we serve a multi-county area in Middle Tennessee, and people are welcome to come from any part of Middle Tennessee. There are, you can just consider us. We do serve Middle Tennessee, and there are lots of counties involved in that. But anyone who's interested, of course, in counseling and or, attending a support group, we're welcoming of people to do that.
Mm-hmm. Great. And so to go back to talk about this experience of, going through the grieving process for people and that concept of disenfranchised grieving, that groups may go through, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender clients and their families. what if we could talk a little bit more about that family dynamic piece when it comes to going through grief and the end of life issues? What kinds of special circumstances have you seen throughout your time with the Life Hospice and in that regard?
Well, as we were saying in the first half here, you know, the whole family issue can be so important, particularly in the realm of an illness, because if there's an extended illness, and you know, the issue of where is the family during that illness, are they a part of the couple? Are they a part of giving care? Once again, I think it's very contingent, typically upon you know, how open each individual has been with the family, how accepting the family is, and that usually is a great indicator of how much you're going to be involved in supporting the couple during the time of the illness. And so I think that bodes well for what happens after the loss. Now, that's not always a given. I've seen situations where the family appeared to be very supportive. They knew about the, you know, the lifestyle, etc. But then after the death occurred, all of a sudden there was a whole change of attitude in regards to the estate that was left behind. And I have had circumstances where the remaining partner was quite shocked, surprised, and just completely blown away by the response of the family, who he thought or she thought was really going to be there. And they came in and really started trying to snatch the estate away. So I do encourage individuals, if there is a possibility of an illness that we're going to be dealing with, or even in, you know, in just common everyday life, to try, and if there's an estate that needs to be addressed, to do all the legal paperwork that is possible to ensure where this estate is going to go and make it as airtight as possible. Because you really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And I just would never leave it up for grabs, because I've seen some pretty horrific things that left partners, spouses devastated because of what the families did after the death occurred.
Right. And it's one of those issues where if there's a legal marriage, you know, with a heterosexual couple, if there's a legal marriage, there's something that's more ironclad, that's harder to fight legally for those things. But gay, lesbian couples, it's very different.
It's a huge factor. So I always encourage couples to don't take anything for granted. Try and cover all the bases. Because even if everyone's healthy here and there's no illness, well, don't go around whistling in the dark, because one never knows when a tragedy can occur. So it's not just in the issue of an illness, which perhaps things can be sort of put together at the last minute, maybe. But in terms of a sudden death, there can be absolutely no time. And, you know, if there's nothing on paper, good luck, because you're at the whim and at the mercy of whomever.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be very, very, as I said, devastating when people start showing up and saying, you're out of here, you know,
right,
regardless of how long they were together.
Going back now to just thoughts about the grieving process and why, you know, it's nice to be able to have a support group option or grief counseling option without, you know, a small window of a time limit. We were talking during a break, when I lost my own father back in 2004, I kind of went into what I call triage mode, where it was sort of like just going into the got to do whatever I've got to do, and I'm going to get through that. And it took me about 2 months to reach a point where grief really officially hit me. And I imagine you see that, you know, people are different. With some people, it may be a much more immediate process and something you're going through. And with some people, it can take much longer. People are all different that way, right?
That's another really good point you're making. It's a part of the culture, of course, that it still is rather unbelievable that in our culture we really don't do well with dying. We don't do well with death in general yet. There's a lot of literature out there that didn't used to be out there, but we still don't have much familiarity with the whole grieving process. It used to be a very significant part of our lives back before we became so modern, so industrialized, and so on. But, you know, people typically have no idea what to expect. The issue that you're referring to, of course, is that people often imagine that the bulk of their response to their loss is going to happen at the beginning, near the loss. We certainly know that there is some significant grieving that can be done before the death, if it is an illness. Mm-hmm. But, you know, then that can be helpful. But there is still this grieving process that must take place. The death must be experienced. And people often imagine, although they'll never be able to tell you exactly where they get their timeline from, I guess this will take me about 6 weeks, or I've heard that it takes 3 months. I mean, these are just pulled out of the air. They heard it somewhere, or maybe they read it from a very old Kubler-Ross book or something. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it really doesn't apply. Grief is very, very individualistic. And people can be, in a sense, I know you refer to it as triage mode. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of shock. It can be a kind of trauma that is resulting from the actual death, no matter how much I think I'm prepared. And this is especially true if it's a sudden loss. And so the onset of some rather intense grief symptoms can occur weeks after the death. And it can really be a surprise to individuals because they expect that to all be present at the time of the loss. Mm-hmm. Perhaps if there was a funeral, memorial service, well, it was there, but then it's suddenly gone, and I guess I'm doing okay. And then 2 months down the road, all of a sudden, I'm not sleeping. I'm having all kinds of meltdowns, emotionally speaking. I'm starting to feel really depressed. And what is going on with me? I think I'm just going crazy. And if there's nobody around to say, no, that's pretty normal, considering who you lost here, people can go around and they're suffering in silence because mm-hmm. they don't know any better. And they're ashamed.
They think something's wrong with them, perhaps, or something that's not normal.
Absolutely. And, you know, having these onset of symptoms at 2 months or 3 months, and certainly it can even be much further down mm-hmm. the road, depending on how successfully perhaps someone really has worked very hard at avoiding facing the loss. Mm-hmm. And they can get extraordinarily busy, or they can self-medicate with food, with alcohol, drugs, sex. They can do all kinds of things to avoid the feelings. It won't work because eventually they're going to have, you know, to pay the piper here. And if they don't know what's going on, it can really be extraordinary in terms of their response to it.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk briefly again about what are some of the positives to a group, so a support group kind of environment, to be able to express these feelings of grief.
Yeah, good. Yeah. One of the primary things that happens is I refer to this process of normalization. Now, groups are not for everybody. I want to point that out. Some people perhaps are a little hesitant about coming to group, and we really encourage people to know that, look, I understand that it can be intimidating to think about coming to a group of complete strangers. I don't know, and I'm going to start sharing my intimate story here. So try and make that as absolutely easy as possible to have a go at that. One of the things that happens, I think, that can be so important is this normalization process. And often people benefit from hearing the stories of others who are going something very similar to what they're going through. And it helps them to feel like, well, you know, I'm not so odd after all. And boy, this makes me feel like, wow, I'm part of the whole group here that, you know, I thought I was the only one that was feeling these crazy feelings, and, you know, it's nice to feel like there are other people out there like me.
Mm-hmm. It's very, very worthwhile for people to know. And John, thank you so much for being on the program. John
might
Baker.
Might I say the number again? I may have gotten it wrong.
Please do.
963-4732. I may have gotten the digit
wrong. All right, 963-4732. That's the number to call to register for the group.
Yes.
And thank you so much for coming on the program. It's been a great episode of Queer Talk. Please join us again next week for another. I'm Matthew Stafford. Queer Talk is produced by Dr. Joyce Arnold.